The October 25th, 2013 rain report is coming up in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. From the studios of the Radio Amateur Information Network, RAIN, I'm Gary, N9VU, with this rain report. Ham radio has traditionally been an audio medium except for slow scan TV on the HF bands and ATV on VHF and UHF. Even the ham radio news and information transmissions were audio-oriented until the 21st century. Folks like Bob Heil, K9EID, George Thomas, W5JDX, and Gordon West, WB6NOA, combined forces to produce Ham Radio Nation, an audio and video production available on the TWiT network. Another ham working on his own ham radio videos is Gary Pierce, KN4AQ. Today, Gary produces Ham Radio Now, an audio-video podcast that celebrated its 100th edition in October. For Gary, his ham radio video production started almost 10 years ago.
I've been involved in public relations and as a PIO for ARL. I won the McGann Silver Antenna back in 1992. I was very concerned, along with Alan Pitts, who at the time was the ARL media and public relations guy, and Bill Pasternak, who does Newsline. We were all commiserating about how difficult it was to get video footage or even good still pictures back in 2004 of hams participating in emergency communications or almost anything interesting that hams do. We do a lot of important things and we don't document them. Two things happened. One was the Columbia space shuttle reentry disaster, where it broke up and a lot of the pieces landed over East Texas near the town of Nacogdoches. And a little bit later was Hurricane Katrina. Just about nothing was recorded from the Columbia disaster. And hams had a big part in providing the communications for all the agencies that were out there, because it was rural Texas, and even the sheriff didn't have good communications throughout the entire county. But hams had pretty good communications. So for a couple of weeks, the hams out there were an extremely important part of the effort to recover as many of the fragments from the space shuttle as they could. It was a fairly unsung effort. Now, I was able to talk to the hams that were involved and get a print story that I published in CQ. I was the editor for the FM and repeater column in CQ VHF at the time. What I really wanted to do was take a video camera out there and document it. Well, I couldn't, because even though I'm freelance, I had a lot of clients booked for that time and I couldn't get away. But I really wanted to. When Hurricane Katrina hit, we had the same problem. The hams didn't document what they did. All that valuable activity that went on got very little documentation. It got print documentation, but we don't have pictures. We don't have video. There was one fellow that did go out and shot some video. He was going to make a program, but he never actually did. So we can't look at what hams were doing. And of course, in Hurricane Katrina, hams were extremely valuable, not so much in the city of New Orleans, although there was ham activity going on there, but all up and down rural Mississippi and rural Louisiana. Lots of little counties totally devastated. EOCs just wiped off the map. No communications, no sheriff, no police, no fire. And hams were vital in especially those rural areas. And we have some still pictures, but not much in the way of video documentation. So I wanted to get that. So I started my first sort of documentary unit. It was called Amateur Radio Video News. And you've actually done an interview with me about that at a ham fest a couple of years ago. I still couldn't travel and do as many things as I wanted to do. Just time was a problem. But I did shoot my first documentary, which was in 2004, up at the field day site for the Potomac Valley Radio Club, PVRC, and Columbia Amateur Radio Society that operate under the call sign W3AO. If you check your field day logs or just go look at the ARL results for field day for the past 15 years or so, you'll find them in the number one spot. In 2003, they listed their category as 51A. And I remember working them.
Wait.
51A. Yeah, and I remember working them that year, 2003, from our field day site and saying, nah, all these big guys in the 20s, 30s, 40s, they're doing something squirrely. They're making it up. I thought, I want to go see. So I bought my first professional video camera at the very low end of professional, but still professional. It was about $4,500, and borrowed some audio equipment from one of the companies that I freelance for. Got a friend to come with me and headed up there, and I contacted the guy who was running it, Roel Anders, K3RA, and he invited me up. I invented the name Amateur Radio Video News on the way up and had a friend register a website for me. My friend and I went up there and did interviews and recorded that stuff. Now, I've been working in professional broadcasting for my whole career. I've been an editor. I haven't been a producer. I've been a little bit on the air, disc jockeying here and there, voice talent now and then, but that hasn't been the big part of my career. Mostly I've sat in an editing room with the lights turned out, putting together lots of things, primarily commercials, but a few programs, documentaries, things like that. I knew things from that end of the scale. But in terms of shooting and being a producer out there in the world, not so much. I played with the home video camera a lot, so I was starting to get some techniques for how to frame a shot. But the rest of it, how to ask questions and do interviews, everything was sort of secondhand knowledge from watching video of the producers whose stuff I was editing, how they did it. So I went up to the W3AO site just west of Baltimore. And I documented what they did and found out how they got to 51A. And it turns out I was half right in terms of how they did it. It was a little bit squirrely. They had enough transmitters on the HF bands, sideband, CW, and data, to make up about maybe 18, 19 transmitters. But, you know, this is the spoiler alert. If you haven't seen the documentary called The Last Big Field Day, this is your spoiler alert. You might not want to hear this. They brought in a microwave rover, and that fellow was equipped for operating everything from 6 meters through, well above 10 gigahertz. I'm not sure how high he went, but he went about as high as hams are capable of communicating. And he had an arrangement with someone who was similarly equipped at one of the other field day sites up on the Blue Ridge Parkway. So he had about a 100-mile path. This is not an easy path. They didn't do this across a field. And they proceeded to start on 2 meters and work 3 contacts, one on sideband, one on CW, one on data, and work their way up the spectrum until they had made 3 contacts on each band for filling out about what you would call 50 transmitters. So in that sense, their 51A, or that year 50A, was legitimate. However, it was not simultaneous, continuous on-the-air transmitters. It was one at a time, one mode, 3 times on a band. So it wasn't like they had all that equipment running all together. The reason I called the documentary The Last Big Field Day is that's never been done again, because the next year the ARL changed the rules. They didn't make it impossible for them to operate the way they had done, although they got a little bit more specific about the idea of having all of your transmitters capable of being on the air at the same time. What they did was they took away the bonus points for anything above 20 transmitters. So no strong incentive for having that many on the air, and if you're running below 150 watts, I think, and claiming the bonus points for those transmitters. So even the W3AO operation has never attempted that many, although I think last year there were 29 or 30 transmitters. So they're still big, but they've never gone that big. And since I had waited to edit and produce my program from 2004 when I shot it to 2011 when I finally got it out on DVD, I had the opportunity to call it The Last Big Field Day. That title was purely clickbait or attention getter. So people would say, what? What do you mean, last big field day? But it's true. It was the last field day that anyone did at that size.
You're listening to a conversation Gary Pierce, KN4AQ, had with Rain's head honcho, KC9RP, about the evolution of Gary's current podcast, Ham Radio Now. We'll resume this Rain Report in a moment. This is the Rain Report, available on iTunes and Twitter.
You're listening to The Rain Report from www.therainreport.com.
So I did a few more documentaries on DVD as ARVN, Amateur Radio Video News, and everyone can stop thinking that they need to email me and tell me that, wait a minute, those initials stand for the Army of the Republic of Vietnam. I know that. I did a few more documentaries. I did one on the 2006 ARDF Championship, the Amateur Radio Direction Finding. It's the type of fox hunting that is done all on foot in a park as a radio-oriented form of orienteering, where you've got, in this case, they set out five transmitters and they place them around a park. In orienteering, you do it without the radio stuff. You have a map with all the geography on it, landmarks and terrain elevations, and you have a detailed map of a park. And those are available. This orienteering thing is pretty popular. And the locations are marked on the map. And in straight orienteering, you leave the starting point. It's a timed event. You do a lot of running. If you're a ham with a big pot belly, you might not do quite so much running. And you go find those flags using the landmarks and reckoning and the compass and stuff like that. In ARDF, this radio orienteering, the flags aren't marked on the map. You go find them by direction finding them. And they do it on 80 meters and on 2 meters, and the techniques are vastly different. 80 meters doesn't have reflections. You get a very good bearing on each signal, and it's typically a faster event. 2 meters is loaded with reflections, so you can't trust any one bearing. You've got to take multiple bearings and sort of average them together and find those transmitters, so it takes a while longer. And the last big documentary I did was called Digital Voice for Amateur Radio. I did a lot of traveling for that one. Went to Chicago and St. Louis and Dallas, Alabama, places where D-Star was starting to really take hold. And this was back in 2008, 2007 when I did the traveling, and 2008 when I published it. I produced that documentary. So just a few documentaries. It took a long time to get them put together and put on DVDs. Well, fast forward to about 2.5 years ago, coming home from the Dayton Hamvention, I got a call from Bob Heil, K9EID, the guy that does Ham Nation. Bob had been offered the opportunity to do the program, which became Ham Nation, on the TWiT network, twit.tv. TWiT, for people in the audience, it's a podcasting, Leo Laporte is the guy who runs it. He's now a ham. He's W6TWT. Doesn't like the word podcasting. He likes to call it netcasting. In any case, it's now a fairly huge operation, all on the internet and all the technology-oriented programs, and Ham Nation is one of them. It's on Wednesdays at 9 o'clock Eastern. So they were working on getting that program together, and Bob Heil was going to be the host, and he knew that he would be at a lot of conferences throughout the year, and he needed someone with some broadcasting and ham radio experience to be available as the guest host, the fill-in, when he wasn't going to be available. So we didn't know each other. We run into each other at Hamfest now and then, but didn't have a close relationship. But he was aware of what I've been doing. So he asked me if I would do that, and I said I would. And so I did about 6 or 7 shows as the guest host, was the guest on a couple more shows. But it was an unsatisfying experience for me. It was 1 hour a week. I like doing in-depth programs, lots of interviews, lots of meat. And he wanted to do quick things that would come and go in the program and have a lot of them stuffed into that 1 hour. Eventually, and for some reasons that I've explained on my program on Ham Radio Now, but I think I won't go into in-depth here, he stopped calling me and I decided to do a program of my own, and I decided to do it on the internet and do it routinely, regularly, not regularly scheduled and not live streamed the way Ham Nation and the rest of the Twitch shows are, but nearly live, something I could do one day and have on the internet within 24 hours or so. And I launched it at the Orlando Hamfest, the Orlando Hamcation, 2011. Recorded a bunch of interviews, got some extra camera equipment and this Behringer mixer we've been talking about. I did a whole bunch of interviews with people and did a little bit of field shooting at sort of a Hamfest tour. While I was getting ready for doing that, I was looking for a good name for the program. ARVN and Amateur Radio Video News turned out to be a mouthful. Couldn't get ARVN.com as a website. And there was that Army of the Republic of Vietnam thing that was kind of hanging over it, too. So I needed something catchier. I'm not sure where I thought of the name Ham Radio Now, but somehow I did. As it turned out, although it was a registered domain by a ham down in Florida, he was not going to use it and had just about decided to give it up. It went up for auction through GoDaddy. I joined the auction. I was the only one making a bid on hamradionow.com. I won the auction, but he still had the opportunity to renew it. Well, we had conversed a couple times, and he said he wasn't planning on renewing it, but we had to wait through the time. So I had learned I was going to get it, but I couldn't actually call the program Ham Radio Now officially while I was down there at Orlando. But by the time I got everything online, Ham Radio Now was mine. Registered domain is .com. I market it, and I tell everybody that the domain is hamradionow.tv. because it's a television program. I liked the way Twit was twit.tv, and some of the other video podcasts use the .tv as their domain. So I thought I would go with that. My wife said, no, don't do that. No one's going to understand that's a real domain. And it is something of a problem for everybody who uses it. So that's why hamradionow.com was a good backup. If anybody decides to just do the .com as their default, they'll still find me. So with all that stuff from Orlando, I started getting things online. I needed to find a way to fund the operation. Selling DVDs had been sort of okay. One of the most popular and important things that I had done in terms of making DVDs was going out to the Tapper Digital Communications Conferences. I'd done that in 2008 and 2009, put them on DVD and sold them. And it did okay, did well enough that I covered the costs and made a little bit of money. Well below minimum wage for all the editing time that it took to put those things together. But I got them done. I was realizing that DVDs, first of all, are low definition video, and now we were transitioning to high definition, and I'd bought all new cameras for doing high definition. DVDs will never be high definition. Blu-ray, not popular enough and a little bit too expensive to produce. And everything seemed to be going online. YouTube was capable of handling high definition. Other video services could do it. So I thought, let me go online. I looked to see if there was a way to do it as sort of a pay-per-view or something where people would have to pay money to actually see the videos. First of all, I was worried that no one would actually do that. And second, those capabilities were not available to small independent producers. Pretty much only the big boys could do the pay-to-play. So I went with the PBS and NPR model. You can watch it for free, and I will beg for you to send me some money. The first thing I put out was the 2011 Tapper Conference. The first round of DVDs that I sold, just under $10,000 worth. That's not chicken feed. In ham radio terms, people will look at that and say, oh, that's pretty good, except if you add up all the work that it took to do it and some of the expense. The second year was not so good. 2011, when I put everything online and asked for contributions, it was the only thing I had going, so I could easily tell what was going on with contributions, and they totaled up a grand total of about $2,500. Now, the best DVDs were sold in the 200 to 250, maybe the number one sold about 300. Most of them were 100 or a little bit less. That's how many people were at least buying the DVDs. Now, they probably got passed around, watched at radio club meetings, and far more people saw them. Online, I could easily tell from YouTube's viewer numbers how many people were watching. It was in the thousands. How many people were contributing? Well, it came up to about $2,500. So it cost me just as much to do, except for publishing or printing DVDs and mailing them. And I charged for mailing, so that cost was not something that existed when I was doing things online. But I had some online expenses, internet expenses, websites, things like that. It's a big drop from just under $10,000 to down to about $2,500. That didn't seem like it was going to work very well. Slowly, things have gotten better. I'm putting in nearly full time in producing Ham Radio Now. Just celebrated the official 100th episode. The contributions are doing better. I can afford to wait. Still work freelance, close to retirement age. I'm 63. It's something I can still wait out.
And that concludes our first excerpt from a conversation between podcast producer Gary Pierce, KN4AQ, and Rain's head honcho, KC9RP. Next time, Gary will talk about some of the challenges he encounters producing his Ham Radio Now audio-video podcast. The Rain Report is copyright 1990 through 2013 Rain, all rights reserved. Now for everyone connected with these Rain Reports, I'm Gary, N9VU, bidding you very 73 from the Radio Amateur Information Network, www.therainreport.com.